ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The best design? You never notice it. The kettle, the beanbag, the umbrella, they look the way they do because someone somewhere made a decision and that decision stuck. What does that say about them? And what does it say about us? The objects all around you have a story. Hear them on By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Search By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Jerry, we now have a deal between Iran and the US to be signed on Friday. So what's in it and what's not in it?
Precisely, and honestly, I think it'll be a day-by-day prospect, whether it actually hangs together.
But Trump still says he wants to get the nuclear dust, as he calls it. But you might observe Iran is playing a rather strong hand right now.
And just as the prospect of peace in the Iran war appears to be in reach, other things are rumbling on, like a trade war between China and Europe.
Always the optimist, Geraldine. I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Doog. Let's go roaming. Yes, we're going to get to our guest a little bit later today, Hamish, but he emphasises the importance of a sort of massively changing international scene. And he emphasises this difference between architects and artisans. It's fascinating. And I don't know quite how he was thinking about it in Europe and China, but how he'd apply it to this deal that we've seen, which, look, for once, I don't know whether it'll hold together. Do you think it will?
Well, look, certainly reading the detail of it, it seems like something that could hold together, I reckon, at least until the next phase. In many respects, the most difficult component parts of this are being, you know, the can is being kicked down the road or kicked further along the Strait of Hormuz, you might put it. So I do think the things that we're being told are agreed can be upheld. There's probably another piece to this puzzle, which is Benjamin Netanyahu and whether he effectively does what Trump tells him to do. I think that's always the kind of wild card here. But I do think we're going to get to Friday and that to a large extent. I mean, this is only a 60-day extension, Geraldine. That's the other piece
Right.
That's worth noting. This is not bringing all of the matters that are before Iran and the United States to a closure.
No, it certainly isn't. And look, I think that it's been very interesting that neither Israel nor Hezbollah were named, I think, in this deal. And both of them have to come to the party, as it were, if things are going to settle down. And we'll see whether that occurs. And, you know, you do wonder what is happening with that Iranian leadership, whether a lot of this sort of, I mean, clearly Trump, neither of them want to go back to full war. And Trump's been ready to sign for ages. And they've been, I think they've probably been absolutely dragooning their hardliners in to say yes. So, I mean, I just think, yeah, I'm hedging my bets about whether it really does last.
I have read some analysis that the US is taking the view that by doing this deal, it hands some authority to the not quite most extreme hardliners in the Iranian regime. So it's Bagar Kalibaf, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, former mayor of Tehran, that's been the lead negotiator here. He, you know, we've done a whole episode on him. He has emerged as one of the key power players. Of course, no one has seen the new supreme leader, the son of the assassinated supreme leader, since he was injured in those strikes early on in the first phases of this. So Kalibaf appears to be where a lot of the, I suppose, day-to-day power rests at the moment.
Do you remember when that was first said to us in one of our episodes? About 6 weeks ago, I hadn't heard of him. I mean, sort of heard of him. And suddenly this man emerged. I've never forgotten that, actually.
And so I think on first reading, the arrangements that are agreed as of now look pretty favourable to Iran, right? There's no agreement on nuclear. There's not really any shift in Iran's position on the nuclear program. The discussion about that will unfold at
and
a later date.
Their ballistic program as well, very important.
In addition, they've made no commitment to external militias, you know, Hezbollah, all the rest of it, the Houthis. They've also agreed only to not charge tariffs on ships passing through the Strait of Hormuz for this 60-day period. What happens beyond that, I don't think anyone really knows. There's going to be some kind of new protocol shared between the Omanis and the Iranians for passage through the Strait of Hormuz. In return, there's going to be a lifting of the blockade. There is discussion about sanctions relief, but that appears to be tied to the later progression of the nuclear talks. But I think what's interesting is this argument that the US administration has seen fit to agree something with the current set in charge of Iran, because going even further would only add more authority to the more hardline within the regime. Now, I don't know whether you believe that or not, but that's an argument I've seen made over the past few hours.
No, I think that's plausible. I think that is plausible, given that I think it's so murky. No one really knows who's running Iran. Mm. But, you know, meanwhile, it has taken our attention away from a whole lot of other things that are rumbling on. There really is this fascinating story of a sort of a trade war heading for possibly a big collision between China and the EU. And on the 29th of May, for instance, all 27 commissioners of the European Commission agreed that the current trade relationship with China is unsustainable. I think there's a running trade deficit of about €1 billion a day, would you believe, in favour of China. I mean, in the old ways, we'd say they are dumping. I think there's quite a lot of evidence that they're dumping all sorts of products onto European soil, particularly in the car area, which is, you know, absolutely existential for France and Germany especially. And it is going to come to a head. There's going to be a big EU meeting on the 18th and 19th this week of June in Brussels. And the question is, what will come of it? Because there's just this steep rise in Chinese imports and a slowing of exports to them. And I don't think it can carry on quite as it is.
Well, let's get to our guest. Mark Leonard has been analysing, explaining international relations for a very long time. He's the co-founder and director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. He hosts their podcast, The World in 30 Minutes. He's written books like Surviving Chaos, Geopolitics, When the Rules Fail, which feels right for this moment in time. Here he is now.
Mark Leonard, welcome to Global Roaming.
Hi, it's wonderful to be with you.
Look, let's go to the big news first, because it does appear that the US and Iran have signed some sort of deal. I'm hesitant to call it a peace deal. I think it's a deal. It's due to be signed on Friday. Do you suspect it'll hold up? And, you know, how would you see the sticking points, all part of this new world of constant adaptation that you describe?
Yeah, well, it's not a peace deal in the way that we came to understand them in the past, which are sort of comprehensive deals which try and solve any of the problems. What it is an attempt to get both Iran and the United States of America out of a tricky spot and to postpone a lot of the difficult issues. So they're sort of starting by trying to reopen the Straits of Hormuz. It's not entirely clear how that is going to work. The Iranian authorities have said that we're not going to go back to the status quo ante, and that they're going to maintain some attempts to monitor who comes and goes through the straits, because this is now a new superpower that they discovered as a result of the crisis. So they're not just going to let that go. They have demanded, as part of the conditions for that, a ceasefire in Lebanon as well, and it's not entirely clear whether or how long Tel Aviv is going to stick to that. We've seen from what's happened in Gaza that just because Israel agrees to a ceasefire doesn't necessarily mean that it will stick to it.
But also the point is they're pulling the strings for Hezbollah, so are they going to stick to it too?
Indeed, that's another dimension. And then the kind of final bit, which is the most challenging bit, is this whole crisis started because Donald Trump said that he wanted to deal with the Iranian nuclear program, and that is not going to be resolved now. So there will be a process to talk about that, and the hope is that you will end up with some sort of deal like the JCPOA, the deal which President Obama signed with the Iranians, which Trump quit when he was president the first time. But that is not something which is going to happen in the next few days. So there's a lot that can still go wrong in the weeks ahead, whether it's in Lebanon, whether it's more problems in the Straits of Hormuz, or discussions getting bogged down on the nuclear issue. And in the meantime, lots of different countries around the world have been quite terrified by the fact that this war came out of nowhere, that they weren't consulted on it, and they're all making alternative arrangements. And it's very, very striking how much uncertainty there is amongst American allies, both in the Gulf, but also, further afield.
So, Mark, what impact do you think the lifting of sanctions on Iran might have on European trade, which is your sort of particular fascination? I mean, is this theoretically quite a win for Europe as well as Iran?
Well, when the JCPOA was signed, there was a hope that you could return to a situation where Iran was being bound into having, something to lose from not having good relationships with Europe, with America, and with the developed world. There were attempts to invest in Iran. Total, the big French oil company, was about to open big facilities there and launch major investments there. There are investments by Airbus in terms of renewing the Iranian fleet, which has been suffering a lot from their aircraft fleet, which had been suffering a lot from the sanctions regimes. And as soon as Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, it became impossible for any of those things to happen. I think people are going to be extremely careful before they go back in now, because it's quite clear that the peace is very fragile, that we have a somewhat mercurial and unpredictable regime in Washington, and the politics in Tehran is also unpredictable, given what the country's been through over the last few years. There's a lot of, as I said before, there's a lot of social unease and tension, which would be putting the regime under a lot of pressure were they not in a state of war. I suspect you're not going to see a kind of huge wall of European capital flowing into Iran and a massive increase in trade in the short term. I think the big hope from Europeans is that the Straits of Hormuz open up so that you get access to jet fuel and other types of energy products, not necessarily from Iran. But the fact that Iran is going to be able to sell its oil and gas into the world will take some pressure off of global energy markets as well.
You're listening to Global Roaming from Radio National. It's Hamish here with Jerry. Our guest on this episode is Mark Leonard. He's the co-founder of the European Council on Foreign Relations. So, Mark, I would have thought in that context, Europe would be thinking, gosh, we might now have the opportunity for things to return somewhat to normal. We're going to get more oil flowing and we want to stabilise certainly the trading environment. And yet your assertion is that Europe might in fact really be angling up to China, possibly with some kind of trade war. Is that really what's brewing?
I think what's happened in Europe has been, over a very short period of time, the effects of China's economic decisions have coupled with the closing of American markets after Liberation Day have led to an enormous, what people are calling a China shock 2.0, which is doing an enormous amount of damage to European companies, particularly in Germany, which is Europe's industrial superpower. And we're going from a situation where China was had an economic model which was very complementary with the German economic model. They were buying lots of German machine tools and German cars, and where China was exporting industrial products, they weren't competing with German ones, towards a situation where China is literally replacing a lot of German products, is in competition with most of German industry. And this is not just in the bilateral relationship, but also in third countries where Chinese companies, which are highly subsidized and which get kind of scale from this kind of huge protected market in China, are able to undercut European exports. And the results have been absolutely devastating to large parts of the German economy. And you're seeing companies like Volkswagen, you know, laying off 50,000 workers, closing factories. And a lot of the core industrial base, which was at the heart of Germany's post-war identity, is now being threatened. And people are worrying that, you know, Baden-Württemberg and other kind of prosperous German states could end up looking like Detroit. You know, when
Are they panicking or not?
They're totally panicking, yeah. So there is a kind of panic in the political debate. And that's also being replicated in some other countries. One of the difficulties is that European countries aren't all in exactly the same place. So some countries have done well out of Chinese investment. Spain, for example, has had a number of EV plants opened up, and they are more kind of open to the idea that China's growth could help them. But there has been a rapid change of heart as far as China's concerned. And the basic problem is that China has been doubling down on exporting cut price industrial surplus to the rest of the world rather than stimulating domestic demand. And European governments realize that if they don't act soon, they could see entire swathes of their industrial capacity wiped out by these Chinese exports. And as a result, you have some quite bold ideas being put forward. The French government, for example, has been suggesting, well, some people in the French government have been suggesting a 30% tariff on all Chinese imports. I don't think the Germans are going to be up for that, but it shows the sort of direction of travel of the debate. And there is going to be, in the next couple of weeks, a very important meeting of European governments where they're going to decide what to do. They also, you know, have... I was in China a few months ago, and part of the problem for Europeans is that they have a credibility crisis, because after the Liberation Day tariffs, Europeans did a deal with the US at Turnberry, which looked like a capitulation to the Chinese, at the same time that China was pushing back very aggressively by weaponizing rare earths and magnets and other tools. So I think they might, you know, the Chinese look at the Europeans, compare their response to their own response, and they don't understand it's actually quite a different situation, because Europeans depend on the US for support in Ukraine. And they have a very different sort of relationship with the US to the one that China wants to have. So I think they might be overestimating European weakness and could end up actually provoking a much harsher response than would have been the case if China had moderated its policy approach and had been less aggressive towards Europeans.
Well, that brings us rather nicely then to your sort of overview diagnosis that in this world that is just fundamentally changed, you just make no bones about it, that old world that we've had for the last 80 years is gone, it's not coming back, and that the new world will be dominated by architects and artisans. And you put quite a lot into these two different descriptions. Now, what's the difference and which countries are you referring to?
So, yeah, as you say, my sort of starting point is that we're entering a period of what I call unorder, which is different from disorder. Disorder is a time when people agree on what the rules are and some people break the rules. Unorder is what happens when we don't have any shared frameworks. There are no agreements on the rules. There isn't a kind of stable balance of power. And as a result, you just get countries doing what they want in an unconstrained way. And
is that nihilism?
I'm not sure it's nihilism. It's just what happens when you go from having, you know, Henry Kissinger said that the world order depends on two things. One is a sort of balance of power. So you need to have a kind of relationship of power between different countries that's reasonably stable. And secondly, an agreement about some rules of things that you won't do as well as what you will do, which people might not love, but they will accept because the consequences of not accepting them are very bad. And you had those two conditions for, you know, most of my lifetime. You know, during the Cold War, there was a balance between the Soviet Union and the US. After the end of the Cold War, the US was so much more powerful than anyone else that it was a kind of able to underpin a kind of global order. Whereas at the moment that has eroded. The US is still enormously powerful, but it doesn't have either the ability nor the will to uphold a global rules-based order. China's not trying to replace it. And as a result, you've got things like what's happening in the Straits of Hormuz, where different countries are doing things without any real reference to international law. And that leads people to think about how do you survive in this kind of in this world. And I have this kind of these two models for thinking about survival. So one is as you said, the architects. And in many ways, the Americans and the Europeans after the Second World War were the kind of models of the architects. They designed a beautiful global system with the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and NATO, and a whole series of different institutions and rules. Another way of thinking about how you survive in these circumstances is what I call the artisans. So they're not people who start with an ideal blueprint for what the world should look like. Instead, they try and understand where the world's going anyway, and they will adapt to it. Instead of building things from scratch, they'll reuse old materials. They'll try things out. They'll improvise. If things don't work, you get rid of them. You try new things out. And the model for that is China, I think, because China came back to the global prime time in an order that it didn't create, and was willing to use some of the institutions for its own end. So it got quite active in the World Trade Organization and the UN system and the IMF and other institutions. But it also kind of created its own institutions like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS. And it tested different things out, the Belt and Road Initiative, other things. But what it hasn't been trying to do is to build a global architecture which looks like the American-led order that's trying to solve global problems on behalf of all of humanity. Instead, they've been much more opportunistic, and their main goal has been about insulating themselves from the chaos around them and building relationships which allows them to have access to the raw materials that they need, to have markets for their products, but also to shield themselves from attempts to interfere in Chinese internal affairs from the West and from other countries. And it's a much more flexible, improvisational way of thinking about order.
But I also wonder whether this particular lens for viewing China looks different depending on where you're sitting. Like I wonder whether from Europe, China does look more like it fits in that artisan category. But if you are in Asia or Southeast Asia, maybe China does look a bit more like an architect and is trying to design a framework and a system, certainly in this part of the world. I mean, maybe I'm not totally catching the nuances of your argument, Mark, but I wonder if it does look different.
I think it's definitely true that what we're seeing is a move away from one world where everything looks the same towards one where things are much more fragmented and you have kind of parallel systems, coexisting with each other. I've been going to China for a couple of decades now, and it is very clear that China might not want to replace the United States as a sort of global hegemon in terms of creating a global order, but it definitely has aspirations to be the prime player in Asia. But what I'm talking about is less about, you know, whether they're ambitious or not and whether they're pushing back on other powers, which they're definitely doing. There's no question about it. They're very unhappy with America playing the role that it has done in Asia. They're unhappy having alliance structures which are organized against them in Asia, and they're trying to kind of undermine that in all sorts of different ways. But I think the way that they're doing it is quite improvisational and a bit more flexible. And you've seen, you know, just in the couple of decades that I've been going to China, you've seen them try all sorts of different policies in Asia, working with ASEAN in different ways, thinking about having an East Asian community, thinking about using the Belt and Road Initiative in different ways, but also kind of unilateral policies of changing facts on the ground, using very, very brutal the techniques against countries that get on the wrong side of them.
And you think that's like artisanal, you're saying?
I think they're sort of trying different things out, seeing if they work, rather than trying to build an alliance structure like the US alliance structure. They have got, you know, very few actual alliances. Just North Korea is the only country that they have a treaty-based alliance with. So I think they realise that if the game is about alliances versus alliances, it's not a game they're going to win against America. So they therefore try and turn that into a virtue. And they say, oh, actually, we're against alliances. Alliances are like very old-fashioned. It's very much about Cold War thinking. We want to move beyond Cold War thinking and allow countries to be sovereign, and we'll help them exercise their sovereignty. And I can see how that sovereignty thing is more popular in Africa, where China hasn't been the kind of imperial power, than it is with the Philippines or with Vietnam or with countries that they're putting very, very direct pressure on and whose sovereignty they are literally infringing upon with their territorial claims.
Well, Mark, honestly, that's just a little snapshot of what you've been thinking. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that was Mark Leonard there, co-founder of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His book, Surviving Chaos, Geopolitics When the Rules Fail. And Geraldine is certainly talking about a lot of rules failing there. What stands out to you in that conversation?
Well, Hamish, look, I suppose I feel that his diagnosis of where constant disruption takes us is very arresting, that we better actually think about our local places, not just think in this abstract way. I found that, and look, I want to refer, and we'll put it in our show notes, it's a superb interview that he did for something called Agenda Publica with two other European analysts, where it fleshes out more than he said. And it's one of the most cogent overviews of the sort of mosaic that's coming that I've seen. So I'm very affected by it.
I might take a look at that. I would like to delve a little deeper into what his argument is on that particularly, because listening to him, the thing that stands out to me is that I'm not entirely sure it's blind spots. You know, day in, day out, I'm hearing people call into the radio and talk about, you know, just as one example, thinking about voting One Nation for the first time. And then when you pursue the rationale, I think people are quite aware of the possible pitfalls and the possible flow-on effects, but not necessarily, that doesn't necessarily prevent them from thinking. I think it's more of a, I don't care what the outcome is here. I am just so angry.
Yeah, well, you know, I just think that's a completely useless emotion. You know, you're angry. Oh, well, you're angry. You walk in, you know, you get demagogues who come in and totally change your culture. I mean, I think that's amazingly, quite honestly, I think it's folly of the first order to be thinking like that. I don't say don't quell your anger, but for goodness sake, look at what could be lost. And that's what I think he's saying.
Yeah, look, I, it's not my anger, but yes, I'm just reflecting on the conversations I'm listening to here in Australia, which obviously mirror so much of what's going on in other parts of the world right now. Thanks to our producers on this one, Shane Anderson, supervising producer Kylie Gray, and Jerry, more tomorrow.
Indeed, and we're going to post that marvellous interview with Mark Leonard and some other European analysts. It really is, I think, one of the best sort of overviews of the mosaic that we're going to live through. So that'll be in our show notes. Bye-bye, Hamish.
Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.